But if you're heading off to work, consider this. What if your job required you to look a certain way? It's one thing, I guess, to wear a uniform of some sort. But what do you consider to be good looking? I have to say, I'm not really sure. Somehow I'm always drawn to the unexpected and individual features in a person's face. They get my vote, call me kooky that way. The thing is, if you're considered attractive, are you more likely to get a job or a promotion? It's what some researchers call the beauty premium, a tendency to favour attractive people. And apparently it's becoming more pronounced in some workplaces as employers seek workers who can connect with customers and promote their corporate image. Your dress, voice, deportment, body shape are all being sized up in today's job market. And at the top of the tree, corporate high flyers are apparently turning to cosmetic surgery to retain their competitive edge in the workplace. So if you considered this pressure to look a certain way at work, would you consider cosmetic surgery to stay ahead of the game? Or could you think of nothing worse? Joining me is Anthony Elliott, Professor of Sociology at Flinders University and author of Making the Cut, How Cosmetic Surgery is Transforming Our Lives, and Professor Chris Warhurst from the Business School at the University of Sydney, who has a book on its way with the title The Corporate Body, The Commercialisation of Employee Experience. Welcome to you both.
Good morning, Natasha.
Good morning.
Great to have you here. But Chris, the tendency to reward beauty isn't new, obviously, but your research says that it's becoming more pronounced in the workplace. How do you know?
Well, it's certainly not new. There's research going back to the Jesuits, which suggests that the Jesuits used to pick out people as priests who would be amenable to the flock. So it goes back hundreds of years.
Right.
And in that sense, I mean, recently we had in Sydney Pygmalion playing at the Sydney Theatre. And that was about somebody, Eliza Doolittle, who wanted to change her voice, change the way she was in order to get on in life. So it's not a new thing, but there's a volume of research which is coming out now which is suggesting it's becoming more acute in the workplace.
What are the hints? What is the research telling us about what's happening in the workplace?
Well, it's telling us two things. One, generally, across the economy, looks matter. People who are perceived to be better looking, depending upon the research you look at, can have a pay premium of between 10 and 16%. They're two to five times more likely to be employed. And if you're perceived to be less better looking, you're more likely to be first out of the door.
Now, better looking, I mean, I guess there's all sorts of measures, aren't there, about better looking. There's facial symmetry. There's a whole kind of field of science to this and biology.
That's right. And so what tends to happen is, in these types of research, people are asked to assign looks to people. And so they, you know, and they use those typical things about symmetry in the workplaces to assign whether they're good looking, average looking, or below average looking. And then what economists do is then to track their pay and prospects in the workplace. And what they suggest is that across the workplace, whether it's in manufacturing or services, whether you engage with customers or not, if you're perceived to be better looking, you do better in the workplace.
It's the whole package though, isn't it, Chris? It's voice, deportment, it's personal style. It's not just a physical appearance that is part of lookism, as you describe it.
Well, that's right. I mean, people think it's often good-looking people, but actually it's a range of things. It's the way you carry yourself in the workplace. So if you're going to stores, for example, some of the stores that we've been researching, people are asked not to cross their arms because that's unattractive and it's hostile. Now, that's nothing to do with their faces, although, you know, people can be employed because they're perceived to be better looking. But it's also to do with their voices, their sense of dress. So it's a kind of range of different things which make you attractive to other people. Plus, of course, some companies don't necessarily want good-looking people. They want people with the right looks. So if you were working in a surf shop, for example, tattoos are perfectly acceptable. If you were working in an upmarket department store in Sydney CBD...
Or the police force, as it turns out.
Or the police force, as it turns out, wearing tattoos might not be acceptable.
Mm. You describe this as part of a whole movement that you dub aesthetic labour, which you're distinguishing from emotional labour. What do you mean?
Well, emotional labour is the capacity for people to be able to manipulate their emotions and customers' emotions in order to have a good service encounter, as it's called. With aesthetic labour, it's the capacity to shape your body, or employers more precisely, to shape your body and the way you speak and the way you dress in order to affect a good service encounter. So you will be drawn into, you know, going into a department store or a bar because you think there are attractive people there. And as I said, that may be the way they dress, it may be where they verbally interact with you. But the interesting thing, going back to what you were saying before, is in the past, we've all realized that looks matter in the workplace, and we've done it ourselves. You know, we've gone to the gym, we've gone to the hairstylist to have our gray roots, you know, tinged up or whatever. And that's all been driven by us. So it's employees doing it for employees because they realize they'll get a better wage for it.
Yeah.
But with aesthetic labor, it's organizations and employees intervening and training people in how to stand, how to talk, what to wear, all those types of things.
That is so interesting. It's really quite intriguing to think of employee experience, appearance as a skill, quantified as a skill.
Well, that's
frightening.
Well, the interesting thing there is that in some countries it's not. When we've rolled out the research, for example, in Sweden, Swedish employees have said, how can looking like blah, blah, blah be a skill? It doesn't have a qualification. But if you ask employers in the Anglo-Saxon economies, Australia, America and the UK, employers understand it as a skill.
Yes, interesting. Professor Anthony Elliott, come to you. The suggestion is professionals have replaced celebrities as the group turning to cosmetic surgery to reinvent their appearance. Is that the case?
I think there's evidence to indicate that there's a strong trend that way. Look, I agree, Natasha, with what Chris is saying about it's important to keep this in a broader historical overview. I guess the big set of changes that I think are taking place in these early days of the 21st century is it's not just that people are prepared to undergo changes to their appearance and their bodies, it's the extent and the extreme. I mean, we now live in an age in which everything from Botox injections through to collagen fillers, breast implants, face lifts, and so on and so forth. These are the kind of remodelings that are being undertaken, not only in the workplace, but certainly, interestingly, are undertaken in workplace environments in order to obtain a career edge.
Anthony, you've interviewed people who decided to have cosmetic surgery to keep up in the workplace. Can you give us some examples of the sorts of stories you've heard about why they elected to do that, why they specifically are having cosmetic surgery for work?
The stories that I recount in my book, Making the Cut, are basically narratives from contemporary women and men that have undergone the surgeon's knife for a huge variety of reasons. I mean, sometimes it is picking up on a particular sense of company direction or mantra as to age and appearance being and youth and vitality being central. Sometimes it might be a matter of a conflict with someone at work that's younger and it's felt that this is a way to obtain a particular edge.
Mm.
So there's a range of, I guess, different stories involved in why people are considering the surgery options.
What sorts of extremes are they going to? Or is it a little bit of a nip and tuck here or a little bit of Botox to smooth things out a bit?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think one of the things that, and again, it was a point that Chris touched on, in terms of we often associate particularly something which many people regard as extreme, although obviously now in our own time, cosmetic surgery is becoming increasingly more mainstream.
Mm.
But we associate it with trying to create a more youthful or a kind of standout look to really be very beautiful and to be exceptional. What most people have been telling me in interview is that they've undertaken a surgical procedure, in fact, to go unnoticed.
Oh.
What they're trying to do is not stand out for looking older,
mm.
not stand out for... I mean, if you take particularly people, say, in the new economy, by which I mean those working in finance, high-tech, and related service industries, you know, people that in their early 30s, mid-30s, could be at the high point of their career. By the time you get to 50, you know, you're feeling very old, or at least you can be presented as being pretty old by your competitors. So one of the things that I guess cosmetic surgery offers is not just a rewind, but a chance to camouflage, to hide away from these social markers that are increasingly, you know, in an age of contract-only labour, seen to disqualify people from the workplace.
Well, that's key to you. You believe that the boom in cosmetic surgery is in fact related to job insecurity, to the increasing short-term contracts, casualisation of the workforce and the like. Do you know this for sure?
Look, I think absolutely. There's a huge amount of both scholarly evidence, but also as a result of, in terms of my research, which was a 5-year study of contemporary women and men actually on both sides of the Atlantic, which indicated, I think, fairly conclusively that there's this acute job insecurity. I mean, the twin forces, I think, of the communications revolution and the advent of the global electronic economy means that we no longer live in a world where people have jobs for life. I mean, this is increasingly now a world of contract labour, of episodic labour, of team projects, of people moving from project to project. And consequently, it's produced huge uncertainty in people's emotional lives and huge uncertainty in terms of the way in which people think about their actual work. And consequently, rightly or wrongly, I think many people are now deciding that a freshly purchased facelift or some suctioning of fat through liposuction could be the best route to maintain or enhance your career prospects.
As you've wondered, perhaps tongue-in-cheek, and these are your words, it's better to promote your own assets than rely on your track record, since the latter is already yesterday's news. What a kind of cynical take on the contemporary workplace.
It may seem cynical. I guess the point is that resumes and CVs, I mean, anything that documents past achievements, because of the drastic speeding up of our economy, you know, in terms of just-in-time deliveries and global offshoring and outsourcing and so on and so forth, means that, you know, people, I think, are less and less judged on their records, their achievements of yesteryear. What now matters, particularly in the new economy for large-scale corporations and companies, is employees being able to demonstrate their adaptability, their flexibility for change. And one way you can demonstrate that to colleagues and to employers, of course, is through personal makeover.
Mm. Chris Warhorst from the University of Sydney. We have anti-discrimination legislation in Australia. It operates on the basis of age, gender, disability. Are there any provisions if you feel you've been discriminated against on the basis of your appearance? I mean, tricky to prove, I imagine.
Well, that's one of the issues. There is a law in Victoria, part of the Equal Opportunities Law, which has a physical features element into it. So if you think you've been discriminated on the basis of your physical features in the same way that you're discriminated on the basis of religion or sex or disability, you can make a complaint. And since it's operated since 1995, there have been more than 1,000 complaints made against this.
Is that so?
And it's now fairly embedded in the list of complaints. It comes, you know, it comes after sexism and racism, but before various other disabilities. But one of the problems they've really got is, how do you prove that somebody is discriminated against on the basis of their looks? Because somebody will have to come forward and say, they think I'm too ugly for this job. And it does happen, and they do research this, but people tend not to do that, partly for the social stigma. And so you find that when people think that they're being discriminated against on the basis of their looks, they typically, in other jurisdictions, whether it's the United States or the UK or elsewhere in Australia, bring complaints forward on the basis of sexism or disability. Mm. So, for example, there was a very prominent case a couple of years ago, I think 2009 in London, a woman called Riam Dean, who worked for a retailer, who was put in the back office. She wasn't allowed to work with customers. And because she had a prosthetic arm, and it contravened the looks policy of the company, and she had to bring Ouch. Forward a complaint on the basis of disability. But it was absolutely clear during the employment tribunal this was about the way she looked and whether or not the company thought she was putting employers off. Now, the problem for this particular company was they didn't realise that she was a law student.
So she went for it. And what happened? She won. Yeah. Well, you can imagine why. But your concern is that this is the new frontier of employment discrimination. Discrimination on the basis of appearance.
I think so. I mean, as Anthony is rightly saying, there's a proliferation of this now, and it's become, and interventions are becoming more extreme. And in the same way, I think that race and sexism were something that we thought, which were perfectly acceptable 20, 30 years ago, I suspect over the next 10, 15 years, we're going to start looking at whether or not we should be rolling out laws against lookism in the workplace. But it is particularly tricky to operate.
It's really tricky to ask this, but could we ever say that it's reasonable for employers to discriminate on the basis of someone's appearance if they can demonstrate that it's critical for the job?
At the moment, if there's what they call a bona fide occupational reason for doing that, they can.
So, for example?
Well, if you refuse to wear particular clothing in the workplace, and another case, for example, in the UK was a person who worked for an airline company who wore a crucifix as a necklace, and the company wanted to take that off because they thought it might offend some people, some of the customers. She refused to do it, and she was sacked for not doing that.
It's slightly different, though. That's kind of attire, isn't it? But when you've got a kind of inherent appearance, a crooked nose, you know, a wayward eye, you're too short, you're too tall.
Well, this is where then employees would come forward, particularly on with disability, rather than try to pursue it as a physical features claim, although they might try and do that.
What do you think the take-home message is here, for if there is one for people? Are we going to see a return to finishing school?
Well, in a sense, that's a good point, because we used to have finishing schools and the middle classes were always very good at doing this. And now the middle classes are being squeezed, as in the way that Anthony's been suggested. They're feeling more insecure in the workplace. So it might be that we go back to a situation where we start to realise that it's not just physical features, but the way people act and talk in the workplace matters. And my concern, my real worry here, is that what we will do is try and displace things like qualifications with looks. So in other words, people say, why get into so much debt going to university when I can just have a bit of nip and tuck and do very well in the workplace?
Ouch. Anthony, Elliot, do you share this concern? I mean, are there dangers to this trend?
Look, one thing I would like to say, Natasha, we've talked about this morning from two perspectives, that of either the employee undertaking these changes willingly or from the standpoint of the actual company or corporation. I mean, I think it also needs to be pointed out, this is far more wide-reaching and institutionally driven than perhaps our conversations recognising. I mean, if you just think about financial institutions and the whole financialisation of the lookism that Chris is trying to underscore, This is really important. Consider, say, you know, the banks. I mean, right throughout the United States, it's pretty easy to go in and get a loan to undertake plastic surgery. It's not just in the United States. Increasingly on a global level, it's not long ago that Lebanon's First National Bank rolled out a loan for plastic surgery. And within the 5 years in which that's happened, cosmetic surgery there in the Lebanon has basically doubled. It's now an industry worth approximately $30 million a year.
Wow.
So my point is that, yes, I mean, obviously you need the agents of the change. You need the employee, the women and men willing to undertake these changes. Yes, it's got to be written into a kind of corporate environment in which this is, if not explicitly, then at least deemed something that is acceptable at some kind of level. But you also need institutions, economic, cultural and social institutions that can drive these changes. So do I see it as inevitable? It seems to me that it is becoming increasingly far-reaching. I mean, it's everywhere from Melbourne to Madrid and Tokyo to Tehran. So it's increasingly global. Is it good or is it bad? Well, sociologists have the luxury here of stepping back and saying we don't make those moral judgments. We're analysing the kind of changes that women and men are undertaking today.
Chris Warhorst, isn't there something, final question to you, isn't there something to be said for the uniqueness of a person's appearance? Do we want people to look all the same to some sort of arbitrary ideal that is meant to reflect on their performance?
Well, just picking up on Anthony's point, I mean, one of the things about globalisation is there is a kind of trajectory now towards a Western beauty ideal. I mean, we're seeing huge markets opening up for the cosmetic companies in India and China for things like nose straightening, for skin whitening. Changing the shape of their eyes because they want to adopt a Western ideal. And there's a lot of research which is suggesting that this was a kind of idea which has been created through Hollywood and the magazines in the West.
It's another type of colonisation.
It's another type of colonisation, exactly. And that's why, as Anthony was just saying there, it may be that what we're doing is moving to an area where this is becoming more acute.
Mm. Look, can I thank you both for joining us? I think this is ripe for conversation, and I'll encourage the Life Matters listeners to get in touch via our website abc.net.au/radionational/lifematters, or our Facebook page. RN Life Matters is the term to search. Professor Chris Warhurst at the Business School at the University of Sydney, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Natasha.
And the launch of your book later this year, I think, The Corporate Body, The Commercialisation of Employee Appearance.
That's right.
And Professor Anthony Elliott, Chair of Sociology at Flinders University and author of Making the Cut, How Cosmetic Surgery is Transforming Our Lives. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
And we'd definitely like to hear from you on this one, so do get in touch. And there's also our listener line, 02 833 1430, where you can leave us a message, and sometimes we even play your calls on the air. Coming up, look, a very, very tough topic. We've covered it last month on the show, but this is a slightly different perspective: self-harm.